A United States senator from Alaska from 1969 to 1981 has a distinguished political record. As a member of the Alaska House of Representatives from 1963 to 1966, he co-authored and sponsored the act that created the Alaska Commission for Human Rights. In June 1971, when whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg's attempts to publish the Pentagon Papers were being blocked by court injunctions, well, I think it's easy to forget that it wasn't just automatic that Ellsberg was able to get the Pentagon Papers into the public record. It was by no means automatic, but it happened because Senator Gravel inserted 4,100 pages of the leaked documents into the congressional records of a Senate committee that he had the good luck to be chairing, declaring, and I quote, that it is my constitutional obligation to protect the security of the people by fostering the free flow of information absolutely essential to their democratic decision-making, unquote. During the same year, Senator Gravel conducted two extended filibusters in the Senate against the extension of the military draft. Now, there are many other initiatives on his part that I could mention, but he left the Senate in after the election of 1980, returning to politics, however, in 1989 as the initiator and leader of the Democracy Foundation, which promotes direct democracy. In 2008, he was a third-party presidential candidate, and he continues to advance progressive policies on peacemaking and international diplomacy, on global warming, taxation, healthcare, reproductive and gender rights, and human rights. In his Declaration of Independence 2008, a text that resonates very interestingly with that other Declaration of Independence, Senator Mike Gravel declared, and I quote, "The malevolent, corrupting power of money has caused repeated injuries to the public interest. The President and the Congress are steeped in a culture of secrecy that denies the people knowledge of what their government is doing to them and to others in their name. The Presidency and the Congress have redefined the criminal act of terrorism as an act of war in order to maintain the nation in a constant state of war, which, in the words of James Madison, is the worst of all evils in that it facilitates the control of the many by the few." Unquote. These are wonderfully resonant words. Senator Mike Gravel will now address these hearings on the subject of the importance of resisting state deception, the Pentagon Papers and 9/11, and the need for a new investigation. Please welcome Senator Mike Gravel.
Thank you very much. Very, very much. I first want to acknowledge this young lady over there. I was unbelievably moved by her presentation. It's because I'm old. She's young. That's the future. And that's what touched me, is that we've got some really able people coming forward. And so not only does she exhibit this intellectual prowess, but she's there doing the grunt work to make this a successful convocation. And so when you see a person of intellect that's not afraid to get down in the trenches and dig, that's something to behold and is beautiful. And so I thank her for being who she is, and I thank her husband, who I've had contact with, and I thank the steering committee for making this possible. It is an awesome convocation. Please. The other thing that struck me was the information. I'm a knowledge junkie, like probably most of you. And so just sitting here listening to this stuff, it's like a kid in a candy store. You get so excited, my God, I just learned something new. And so that's the credit to the professionals that are participating here. But what I was struck with is the degree of professional integrity that they exhibited, and something that's very different that you don't normally see with that degree of intelligence, a great deal of humility. And so I was just touched by that. And so I just feel so privileged to be here. I'm going to try and keep my remarks to a half hour, and you can start cueing me when I reach that, because I want to get more into Q&As. I'm severely dyslexic. That's the reason why I don't read a speech, but it's given me a little bit more ability to speak extemporaneously and show more passion than just reading. And so, and I'll look forward to their questions. I've given them all copies of a document. It's close enough to what I'm going to say, but there is going to be some departures from that. One of the most important things to understand is, from my point of view, how I got here and why I'm here. Because I don't take the same position of the scientific community that I behold. What I behold is that this knowledge has to get out to the people. And you need an actionable item. And I want to give you one statement about my experience, because I get it all the time. Well, we got to inform the people. We got to do this for the people. Keep in mind, if the people have no vehicle to act upon that information, all you do is create a new generation of cynics. That's all that happens. When you have information as a citizen, you must have a vehicle to act upon it. Now, to understand human governance, you have to understand that the law, Solon, his great contribution to human civilization was the concept of the law being out there. We vote for the law. The majority passes the law, and it's out there. And it's our task to obey it or change it. I can recall one sitting next to Fritz Mondale on the Finance Committee, and he's saying, well, that's the law. And I said, God damn it, we make the law. That's what we're here for. I was on two grand juries, and I hung them both. And I don't know why I was born questioning authority. I just don't know why. It's just my nature. And so I've been blessed with that asset. And so as a result of that, when I look at what you've accomplished in this 10 years, and keep in mind, it is an ongoing accomplishment. The knowledge that you had 5 years ago is not nearly as good as the knowledge you have today and your ability to present it. It is an ongoing continuum. So what you need is something actionable that can turn that into people reacting to it. Because as Laurie said, you're going to make progress. It's going to get out there slowly. It's going to be a hard slog because of the powers that are arrayed against us. But we could speed that up. And we could speed it up with a plan, an actionable plan. Let me tell you how I got to thinking about that with respect to 9/11. For the last 25 years, and even when I was in the Senate, I have a strong belief that the answer of governance, human governance, is not in representative government. It's with the people. But the people, by and large, don't have the power to make laws, because that's the central power of government. It's superior to the executive. It's superior to the judiciary. It is the ability to make laws. And then, of course, if you have the police ability that goes with it, you can enforce those laws or change them. So that's what the people don't have. And so when you look at, and I'll use only the United States. I could make a parallel description of what happened in the parliamentary system in Great Britain. But the key is, would you hand me my lemonade over there? The key is to understand that the people, without the ability to make law, are disenfranchised. And I tell you that as a politician, because I got elected, several elections, in fact. And I'll tell you very candidly how it works. I get money from special interest. I turn around and manipulate you, my constituency. And after you elect me, I look down at you and say, hell, I'm smarter than all of you. I just fooled you. I got elected. That is the way it works. That is the way it works. And so when people say, I can't believe that our leadership would be so criminal to cause 3,000 deaths, my God, realize that that's what they're always doing. Ever since I've been in public office, the leadership of my country that I love, your country and the world, we've just been killing people wantonly. And so you wonder, how could they do this? They do it just easily. They get up in the morning, have breakfast, and go out and make decisions that affect people's lives. You've heard the joke, I'm sure. I kill you, that's murder. I kill a million people, that's foreign policy. I mean, that's what you have to realize, that we divorce our morality as individuals from our collective morality, which is operated on by our leaders. I came to the conclusion that the answer, and I came to this conclusion totally, I was grappling with it for more than a decade, and that is that the answer lies with the people. Very simple. There's only two venues for change. The government, wherein lies the problem, or the people. The problem is the people don't have the power to act upon the knowledge that they receive and what they continue. So I wrote legislation. It's called the National Initiative. And now we have 24 states in the United States that have initiative laws. Every one of those initiative laws are bad law, but it's better than what was there before, much better. And so this initiative is a device, meta-legislation. I don't care about the issue. Meta-legislation to empower you to make laws in every government jurisdiction of the United States, and I hope someday in every jurisdiction, government jurisdiction of the world. The people then would come in as partners, full partners with their representatives, who will then be in a position to do a better job in their representation, because we need good leaders. But the people will be the policymakers. And the minute they come into that scene, they are the senior partners. And under the law, that's National Initiative, you can go to my website. It's NI4D, or nationalinitiative.us. NI4D, and it's a constitutional amendment, and it's a federal statute that sets up the procedures. Now, you don't put procedures in the Constitution. It clutters it up. But what we do is have a constitutional amendment, and I have devised a way to go entirely around the U.S. government without even saying hello to enact this into law, and the law will be enforceable. Now, that took some time. I got to tell you that the writing of the law was a 7-year trial and error experiment, and that's after 16 years of elective office as a legislator. So it's there in place for the people, and that's what the American people don't know. They want to be empowered. Overwhelmingly, polls say that. But if they only knew that on the shelf they could just reach for it, and in no time at all they could be empowered to make laws and to be party to their own governance. Cicero said, very fortuitous, said that freedom is participation in power. You think you're free? Well, you're not free until you can make laws. That's right. Participation in power is freedom. So that's where I come from. So little wonder that I now get pulled in to, well, first let me tell you that when I had one person say, well, you know, we just heard about you getting involved in 9/11 truth movement. Oh, really? And it's sort of implying that, well, I'm a Johnny come lately. I said, how does he know how I was thinking? I was there on 9/11 with a 3-day funk depression glued to the TV. Now, why did I know right then and there that the fix was in? Well, I knew it. I've been following the military-industrial complex and fighting them for the last 40 years. There's a book out, is A Political Odyssey, and by Seven Story Press. And it's about my battle against the military-industrial complex. And I confess I failed. I didn't stop it. But I fought it, and I'll fight it to my last breath. Because when you look at what was done on 9/11, it was to set up the process. The key, Iraq, is incidental, and so is the other. And, of course, the plan they had to then go into Lebanon, go into Syria, go into Iran, and then Saudi Arabia. Thank God that that their incompetence brought about the debacle in Iraq. But that thwarted, because the whole plan, the neocon plan, and when I say the neocon plan that I've been following, when I was a senator, young Richard Pearl, who was working for Scoop Jackson, would come on the floor. And he had and Scoop had another person that I would glare at them because I knew what they were there doing. And Scoop Jackson was this big Democratic president that everybody thought one of the powerhouses. He was my biggest enemy in the Senate. Biggest enemy in the Senate. Oh, it's easy to spot the Doles and the other idiots. But this guy was a Democrat. He's on our side. Incidentally, I just add, this is why I have more concerns over Obama than I have over George Bush. I could recognize George Bush as an idiot. Obama, he's a different cut of the cloth. But so now you have a situation. Why did I begin to think of that I should get more visibly involved with 9/11? Well, it's very selfish. I've got my own plan. My plan is that if we can get a commission to take what you people have put together, discovered, developed, if we can get that functioning on a legal basis, not just what your work is not legal. You can't enforce it. And the people know this. And so if we could get you a commission so that you can bring forward everything, and it's all there. I mean, you talk about a commission taking off at the get-go, it will be just pulling in all that you've done. And just in rapid fashion, getting more. So, Richard Gage, because I had already been there, because I just intuitively knew the fix was in, because I know these people, I know them very, very well. Richard Gage asked if I would moderate something at the press club in Washington, D.C., a debate between the government people and the true believers, the truth movement. I said yes. And so that was on a Thursday. And lo and behold, after that experience, I had to become a little more knowledgeable about some details. And then he said, well, what about coming to New York for this meeting? And Niels and his wife refreshed my memory that we were in the cab today together. And, of course, as I get older, I forget less but or forget more. And so I went to this meeting. And that's when Barbara Honegger was able to promote that third light, which is just dynamite. You'll see, and we use them, all three lights in our logo. And so I went there, and it was late at night. The panel, I was over in one side, and it was just a bevy of us. And I just came out because I had this in the thought of my mind during the effort made to have a commission established under New York City law. Every time I would go to New York, I was campaigning for president at the time, they would invite me, would you come and help us and be there at the press conference so we can use your cachet to get more attention? Every time I did it. And one thing was very, very sad. One of the first responders, big burly guy, he came up to me almost to assault me because he must have thought that I was still a sitting senator. And he was saying, I'm dying, and he's spitting blood in his handkerchief. And he says, I'm dying, and he's really right up next to me. And he said, I'm dying, and you got to do something about it. I mean, I just felt so powerless. But it registered with me. And as a result of that, I became very committed to try to make, to help out. And so at this meeting, how I could help out was just I threw out there. I was just tired. It was late at night. I threw out this, well, what you need in the 9/11 movement, which is a knowledge movement, an informational movement, what you need is an actionable item which takes your knowledge beyond just knowledge into acting upon it. And I said, you know, if we had the national initiative in place, you could do this in 30 days. But it's not in place. And the only other tool we have at our disposal, very imperfectly, are these 24 states that have initiative processes. And every one of those states in the processes, they've been constantly sabotaged by representative government, by people in the legislatures, to diminish the ability of the people to make laws in a convenient, effective fashion. So right after the speech, we were mingling around, and a couple of people came, "Oh, Senator, this is a great idea. Will you help us?" Well, that's when I got trapped. I said yes, and then I had in my mind that the best state to attempt to do this would be California, because it's the most visible initiative state. There are better states, as I subsequently developed, but it was just an idea that I threw out there. It didn't have any flesh on the bone, but I had to develop an assessment as to how extensive was the 9/11 truth movement. I made a tour. Somebody offered to put the money up, and so I made a tour of California from one end to the other, and became convinced that, boy, there's a lot more here than meets the eye in a way of power. That's when I first met Dr. Griffin, went to his house. He had just got through an operation that I had, and I was very sympathetic to him. And so as a result, he gave me one of his books, but I already had some. And because of the people that I later became associated with, became very knowledgeable about what was going on. And of course, this meeting here was the frosting on the cake. So after making that decision that, well, there's enough people out there if they could be brought to coalesce. Now, knowing a lot about cause groups, that's wishful thinking. Because it doesn't happen that way. Everybody's got their own little turf, everybody's got their own little things that they're doing that they think is important, and they are important. They're important to them, they're important to the collective. So what first step that I did is to say, well, now I gotta put my money where my mouth is. I've gotta write a piece of legislation that will make this thing work. Because it's never been done before to initiate a commission, essentially a grand jury. Remember, in history, we had grand juries that were just dynamite. The people would go after the corrupting influence of society. They'd set up a grand jury. That's where the terminology, a runaway grand jury, came from. And as soon as the politicians understood that, they were able to pass laws to stop the runaway grand juries, which was the biggest threat to their ability to use their corrupting practices. So I had to figure out how to. So I I'm not an attorney, incidentally. And I once told that to Ramsey Clark, and he says, "Mike, stop bragging." And so I went to the Legislative Council. Now, I do have a cachet, and I'm known by some people, so I can always get a phone call responded to. So I called them up. I said, "Look, I'd like to get up there and to Sacramento and sit down and draft some legislation with you." "Oh, Senator, we admired you from the Vietnam era and all of that, and I'm using that." "Oh, great." So I get up there, and we draft legislation. They happened to have assigned a young man, an attorney, young attorney on the staff, who had donated to my presidential campaign. So you can imagine where his head was on the subject. Well, we developed. Which was one of the unique features of this law that we now have, and that is a joint powers agreement. The difficulty of doing an initiative in this state, and that state, and that state, you're not going to have 10 commissions. You're going to only have one commission. So you have to harmonize this collective decision at the state level by these people into one commission. And the harmonization process is a very simple thing. This law that I'm talking about right now is only 4 pages long. And so what we did is we created a joint powers agreement. Now, I knew before that idea came up that we could do a compact. And then I did a little bit of research. Well, to create an interstate compact, you have to have the blessings of Congress. Well, that ended that story real quick. And so that's when we came up with this new concept of a joint powers agreement. And the way the agreement works is if it passes in any one state, look upon it like a glass of water. If he wants to hook onto it, he can hook onto it. If you want to hook onto it, you can hook onto it. It's a vessel that we create legally that anybody, any state government, with or without the initiative, can latch onto. Now, in the problem we had in California, is, and this is the next major problem of the law, is how do we appoint the commission? I have created in my career two major commissions. I was able to promote Japan, Panama, and the United States when I was one of the leaders of turning back the canal to Panama. A creation of a commission, it was funded to build a sea level canal funded by Japan initially. And then I had another commission that took me a year to design and create, and that was a transportation commission using all forms of transportation into one definition of what is the most efficient mode of transportation energy-wise so you could set priorities. Well, lo and behold, both commissions turn to crap, nothing. Very simply, why? Because I designed a commission and it was run by bureaucrats who had no vision. And it was, and in both cases, it was sabotaged by a Republican president. And so I've learned the hard way that, boy, you not only have to have the idea, you have to have a device to make sure that the vision is realized from the originators. And so what we did in California, which I was very antsy about, in fact, initially I realized the answer that they had was, well, we'll use your credentials as a former senator and legislator, and that that could probably wash, because constitutionally you cannot appoint a person with under the law of California. That's the reason why our law would be a constitutional amendment in California, which means it raises it by 200,000 or 300,000 more signatures you got to get on the petition. I saw that and I said, well, boy, people are going to look at this and say that I'm just trying to be self-serving. And so I called up Cynthia McKinney. I said, Cynthia, I got a deal for you, Cynthia. How would you like to be the mover, the prime person to be on our law? And so you head it up, and I'll follow you. Okay? So we'll put Cynthia up front. And Cynthia says, oh, Senator, no, no, I want to follow you. You're just awesome. So I got suckered into that one. But I didn't feel right about it. And it was some element of criticism within the movement. What's Gravel's talking about? He's coming up with an idea, and he's the one that's up front on it. Well, we went from there, we went to Oregon, which is an ideal place. And now, the reason why we went to Oregon is very simple. It would cost $1 million to $2 million to win in California. So Oregon, you only need about 60,000 to 70,000 signatures. Very complicated process to do it. And so I, again, used my cachet, call up the Legislative Council. Now, we already had a law in the can that the Legislative Council of California bought. So that was encouraging. Because now the Legislative Council is the one that would critique if you put up an initiative. That's the organization that they would turn to, will find the flaws in this. Well, here I had a law under stationery that they helped me write. So that was solved. So I pulled the same thing in Oregon and sat down. Young lady, young Polish extraction lady, very, very bright young lady. And so we designed the law. And what they had is they had no constitutional prohibition, which incidentally is a good prohibition, no question. You shouldn't be able to name people in these kind of things. So they didn't have that. So that's when we refined the joint powers agreement, saying that who will appoint these members of the commission? Well, it's got to be somebody. So we don't have an individual. We just say that it will be the steering committee that is waging the campaign to bring about this initiative. And that could be anywhere from what it is right now, 5-6 people, to 20 people, because we'll pick them up as we go along, and then they'll be able to participate. And what we do, we will solicit from the general public list of nominees who should be on the commission. And so when people say, well, what's going to be the criteria? Well, that's a problem we're going to have to face, and it's not a minor problem. But like I say, I've been burnt very much on this. And so it's something that if there's anybody that's aware of the importance of picking the right people that will have the guts to go wherever this needs to go, that's what's vital. It's a lot of courage, and that's going to be one of the criteria of the selection. So those are the two key elements. We have a selection process. We have a device where people can latch on to it, whether they do it by initiative or legislative act. So now, in the process of doing this, I lose track of time because I had made an assessment of what states we could go to. And it just, here, I'm getting ready to go to Europe, and lo and behold, I just spotted that the deadline for Massachusetts is August 3rd, and I'm leaving 3 days for Europe. And so I go to Europe, and I'm by the, and what happened in Massachusetts, we lucked out. A group of people, like a rising out of the, like a phoenix. We had an in-place organization that just bought into this concept wholeheartedly. And I mean real bright people, real sensitive people. So lo and behold, and they've all been, they're all truthers from way back. In fact, Lori will like this. They were, in one of the iterations, I said, you know, put in your 2 cents. Well, they took me up, they put in their 2 cents. The second section of the law, they started putting in criminal and murder and things like that. And I said, oh my God. No, that's not the way you do this. And you got to have it dignified. You got to have it proper. And so I said, look, I object to this. I just said I object. And they honored my objection and took it out in the next iteration. There was another area that slipped by me, but we'll correct that later. But so lo and behold, here we have, and I'm in Europe, and I'm on, and I'm by email approving the final text. And they just deferred to me on that because I'm a legislator. And so lo and behold, we got the text. Now we had to get, there's no legislative council in Massachusetts. And so what we had to do is to get the attorney general, that's the lady who lost the election to Brown for the Kennedy seat, for her to approve it, to certify it. And that was to be done on September 7th. Well, lo and behold, September 7th rolls around, and I forgot where I was, but man, when I got the word that it had been certified, I just jumped for joy. What does that mean, the certification? It means that I've got the backing and the acceptance of this law, which has never been done before, by California, by Oregon, and now by Massachusetts. It's locked in. It's locked in. So now the task is real simple. We need the mother's milk of politics. What is that?
Money.
Here, I'll give you the math. It's very simple. And there's nobody in our organization that's wealthy. I mean, we're all as poor as church, but we're all committed. We're activists. And so the math is simple. We need 80,000 signatures. And this is where it gets diabolical, and this is what the politicians have done to us as the people. We have to get those signatures by November 23rd. So you're looking at more than 1,600 signatures a day we have to collect. And we're starting, and it starts now. I'm going to Boston, and I'll be there with Cynthia, and we're going to be at the State House, and we're going to have a big rally, and then we're going to go out with clipboards and get in the trenches and get signatures. I've done this before. I've done four initiatives. Now, as a senator, I did 2 initiatives, so imagine how much faith I have in the system. we're going to do that, but we've got to be realistic. And Massachusetts is so significant. It is, in my political judgment, the best battleground to fight the system. It's a progressive state. It's a media center. Boston is the media center for New England. Boston, and particularly Massachusetts, but Boston is one of the 5 political hubs on the East Coast. Boston, New York, Washington, Atlanta, Miami. That's where we're at, in the boshwash of the nation, where the population is. And so we get visibility there. It's Katie, bar the door for your message. And understand this. This is merely a device for you to not only communicate your message in the process of our getting signatures, because if anybody's going to sign anything, we got to sell them that there's a need. And when people say, do we need to have a new commission? Wouldn't it be a waste of money? Now, I'm not talking about you. I'm not talking about the faithful. I'm talking about what I've heard on the street, people questioning me. Why do we need another commission to study it? This is a waste of money. We got unemployment problems. We got debt problems. Well, it's unfortunate they don't appreciate the full significance of what this is all about. 9/11 generated 3 wars: Iraq, Afghanistan, and the most diabolical one of all, which will finance into infinity the military-industrial complex. And that's the war on terror. Because terror was with us at the beginning of civilization, and it will be with us at the end of civilization. And so now, we're ready to fight that battle in Massachusetts. What we need is money. And we need it in a big sum early on. Because we'll be able to raise several hundreds of thousands of dollars in the course of the year. There's no question about that. This is too good an issue. But we need it now. Because if every day that goes by in Massachusetts, it raises it from 1,700 signatures a day to 2,000 to 3,000. You can just do the math. It's $2 to $3 per signature. That's what it takes. And you can't do it on a volunteer effort. This is a professional business, and we have to approach it professionally. Now, I've set up a corporation in California. It is not the corporation that will do the California Initiative. That will be a separate entity that will do that. We'll have a separate entity in Oregon that will do that one, and in Massachusetts. Because you see, in each one of these venues, you have to have very rigid reporting practices. This is serious. And particularly when we're assaulting the castle, you've got to do it right. And you've got to be very careful in what you do with respect to the details. And so we're not going to commingle funds. What we're going to do is our national organization can receive funds from any place in the world. And I'm prepared to go to Europe on a finance-raising tour. Because when I see the results of a poll in Germany and what's going on in Italy and other countries, I know that there's really serious money that wants to affect the conduct of the United States. And I want to capitalize on that. So I'll be available to do that. But more importantly, we need an angel. Now, we're getting the money coming in. When you saw it, there was a little chart up what we've raised without being in full force, because we didn't know what I had would be accepted in Massachusetts. We've raised over $10,000, $11,000. That's a pittance. And we probably spent most of it on expenses that we've incurred. So now we need an angel. And anybody who can hear my voice and see this presentation, I'm begging you. You have an opportunity. If you can write a check for $100,000, $200,000, please do it. Or lend us the money. We'll pay it back in time. But we need that money now. And I'm begging you, because this is an opportunity that won't come back again. If we miss it in Massachusetts, oh, we'll be in Oregon. We'll be in Colorado. We'll be in California. Fine. But we will have missed this brilliant opportunity of getting it done in Massachusetts against all odds. And so that's the reason why I'm pleading for people. Now, he made my day. Ian came in. I came in, put my bag down. He says, I got a contribution. You want to give it to me later or now? Give it to me now. And that was Global Outlook, contribution right then and there. Now, that's from an organization. Whether it's organizations or individuals and corporations, make no mistake about it. We can take money from corporations, and we bless. Well, this was before the Supreme Court rendered their decisions with Citizens United. But under all of these states, you can take corporate money. But you can't take foreign money. So that's the reason why I'm segregating everything into different organizations, because we're not going to make the mistake of taking foreign money and putting it there. But there's no reason why foreign money can't be used in our central organization, our national organization, to pay for an executive director, to pay for all of the things that we will do, which are informational things. We're communicating, which is really what you're doing, and so we'll be using what you've done to communicate and then set the stage for these states. Did I use my half hour yet? Okay, well, I could go on with a lot more, obviously. When it comes to national initiative, I can, hey, there's a 20. That's okay. Don't give me cash. You want to talk about corruption? That's how you corrupt. I mean, I've seen it in the United States Senate. One senator taking a wad of bills like that and giving it to the other. Go help your campaign. They call it walk-around money. The problem, you could put it in your pocket and forget to walk around. But the problem of getting cash in political campaigns, you got to float it to the top to pay for the TV stuff. You know, where's the money going to come from? Not going to come from the Trinity. It comes from that cash that they're giving you under the table. So, if I could add two things, one on Laurie's presentation, which just moved me. I have a code that I use, which has stood me in good stead. It's not empathy of other people, because there's a lot to be sympathize. It's not sympathy, rather, it's empathy. I just happen to have a good dose of empathy. And so if something, when I see the prejudices lurch up in my soul, and I have them like every other human being, then I get a grip on myself, and that's where empathy clicks in and say, well, what if I were in their shoes? You know, and that's really the great statement by, I forget the chief, Pontiac or whoever it was, said, before you can judge another human being, walk in his moccasins. And that's essentially the code for what she's talking about is human empathy. And it's ties into the golden rule. So let me close on that note. I'll think of other things to say. Like I say, I can go on for hours and hours about direct democracy and how it would function and can answer a lot of questions because, you know, what I get this question. Are there any members of Congress who support what you're doing? Not one. Not one believes in the people enough to put their life on the line. Another one that you should be aware of is to understand how the corruption works and or how the mind of a politician works so you'll know why you've been unsuccessful and you never will succeed in getting the Congress to create a commission for you. Because the Congress will create a commission. They're going to try it. They're going to do just what they did to me in the Pentagon Papers. The minute we were able to publish them with Beacon Press, 2 weeks before we published the Gravel edition of the Pentagon Papers, the Pentagon came out with the Pentagon Papers. This top secret deal was made public. A little redaction, but that was it. So what do you think the powers to be are going to do when we're talking about creating a citizens committee which doesn't give a darn about the government but is looking for the truth and possible criminality? I say possible, that's a euphemism here. And tying it to individuals. What do you think they're going to do? The Congress is going to try to create a commission real quick. And so, but by the time we get enough far down the road, that may or may not be acceptable to the American people or to the people of the world. It may be looked at for what it is, going to be crassly, another government commission to dress things over so that we can go back to sleep. These are the tactics that you can anticipate when you got a devious political mind like I have. So let me close on that note. Let me reemphasize Cicero's great statement. Keep in mind, when he was around, Cicero said, freedom is participation in power. If you do not make laws, none of you have ever participated in power unless you've been elected to office. I've participated in power, and what I saw was terrible. Was terrible. The wanton murders. I will use one area. I want to drive this home. When you say, are these people capable of these murders? Yes, they are. They do it more than not. And I want to give you an instance that I wonder if there's anybody in the room that will tell me if they know this instance. I've told it to a few people privately. And that is that there was an incident in the involving the United States, Canada, and Britain, where they murdered, and that's the word, murdered three times more than were killed in New York and Washington on 9/11. And four times more than Pearl Harbor. What was that incident? Does anybody happen to know it? I'll tell you. No, not even close. At the end of the First World War, Foch had been negotiating with the Germans about an armistice. The Germans couldn't keep their troops online. The French had revolts going on. This was a mess. The only integral group there were the Americans, okay? And the Canadians, of course, were under the thumb of the British. So the armistice was signed by Foch and the Germans at 5 o'clock on the morning of November 11th. It was at 5 o'clock. And hostilities, the shooting, was to cease at 11 o'clock. Now, to the surprise of many widows and mothers, they got notice of their sons dying, and they died at 6 o'clock. They died at 7 o'clock, 8, 9, 10 o'clock, on that very day when everybody knew the war was over. How did that happen? What happened was these generals, under the leadership of Black Jack Pershing, one of the great American military heroes, these generals were ordering the troops over the top to attack the Germans, and the war was over. Now, if that is not criminality and murderous in its very act, I don't know anything that is. How it was discovered? The Democrats controlled the administration. That was Woodrow Wilson. His wife was really running the show at that point. And then, of course, you had the Congress, which was controlled by the Democrats. The Republicans, so typical, well, they get letters from mothers and daughters, and they say, what happened? What happened in those hours, those 6 hours, where more than 10,000 Americans were killed? And so they had an investigation. They had a hearing. Didn't last long. It was a three-day affair, and the hearing showed the full culpability of the generals by name and all of that, and it was just a hard horror situation. So lo and behold, what did the Congress do? Now, this is the criminal acts of our military leaders, which is still going on today. Make no mistake about it. When they tell you about these great generals, I got news for you. But what they did is they said, well, we cannot really make this public because it will dampen the triumphalism of America's role in the First World War. And that Black Jack Pershing is the hero of the nation, and this is not the time to besmirch his reputation. It was put on a shelf, and there it remained until a book came out by Joe Persico, and it's called, look it up, it's a great book. It's called 11 Month. And you got to use the whole phrase. This is the title of the book, 11th Month, 11th Day, 11th Hour. And it's a book about that thick, and it lays this whole thing out. And it's just horrific. So when you question, and you're talking to people, well, can our leaders, can they commit these murderous acts? They do it as a matter of course. Okay? I'll be happy to get interrogated now.
Thank you, Senator Gravel. We will now invite questions from our panelists. Senator Imposimato will question Senator Gravel.
Thank you, Senator Mike Gravel, for your statement. Very interesting.
Louder.
Thank you very much, Ms. Senator Mike Gravel, for your statement. And I want to ask you, do you think that thank your movement we can hope in the reopening of the investigation? The United States prosecutors are independent and are able to investigate on this case. This is the first question. The second is...
Let's just stay with the first question.
You don't
yes. I'm older than the other people, and if they couldn't handle three questions in a row, you imagine what position I'm in. Repeat it. I was just trying to make a funny there. The bringing it, the indictment, bringing about the criminal...
it is possible to...
No. You got to understand that this commission... the normal grand jury has the ability, it's led by the prosecutor. And so he controls the grand jury. And they can generally get a grand jury to give an indictment. They take the indictment, and then they take it over to the judiciary side of the government, and then they prosecute through the court system. So we won't have that power, but we don't need that power. I've learned in time that it's the unintended consequences or the intended consequences that are what's valuable. If you want to begin something, you don't have to know all the answers of the future. All you got to do is step forward and things will happen. And that's what you did in your efforts over the last 10 years. And what I'm saying, now we take your efforts, we add to that an actionable item. But the grand jury that we're creating, this commission, will be able to subpoena and will be able to put people under oath. Now, for those of you that are not aware of it, most criminals, particularly political types, are get convicted over perjury. That's right. So we will have people under oath, and whether it's under oath in Massachusetts or California or Oregon or Colorado, it's still under oath. And you lie, it's perjury. Now, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to look at all the evidence you've pulled up. I mean, I could just all day say, let's go interview this guy, you know, and put him under oath and, here, tell us the truth. In case you don't know the consequences of perjury, we're going to read that for you. I mean, it will be more fun than a barrel of monkeys to go out and go after these people. Now, this is the first time you'll have that kind of a tool. It's a legal tool. It's got, and you'll have, we'll get the money. You know, we're talking about 50 cents a person. Out of California, that's $20 million. And plus, in the law, it states very clearly, we can receive money from any source, public or private. I didn't say American in there. I said any source, public and private. The law is the law, and that's our law, and that's what people will be voting on. So I answer your question. Unfortunately, we will not have police powers, and that's very critical to understand that. But that doesn't mean, but we'll have power that in many respects is beyond police power. Because rather than have a secret commission investigation, I got to tell you, it's going to leak like a sieve. People are going to see what's going on all the time. And so it will be headline after headline about what we're discovering. And that will create a momentum across the country. Hey, keep in mind, my goal is, I think, what Laurie was talking about. My goal with this is to bring about such a destabilizing psychic event in the minds of the public, not just Americans, worldwide, over what was done. Because for the first time, you have done enough work that it's there to show the criminality. And whether it's Bush, Cheney, you name it, another government, another, we will be able to run them to ground. And you've heard that old saying, you can run, but you can't hide. And George Bush can't go to Europe anymore, nor can Henry Kissinger go to Europe anymore. And of course, we're not even touching what the consequences of this will be with the ICC and the Rome Treaty, because that opens up a whole new avenue that they have not begun to really truly grapple with. All that is on the table. Judge, I took a long way to answer your question.
It seems to me that you told that the United States government has sometimes killed innocents.
Sometimes? No, more than sometimes.
Sometimes. Always. No, I have reduced the...
You're too kind.
Are you informed that the U.S. government is involved to the Moro case, killing through and follower of the State Department, Steve Pizzenik, who admitted this crime 2 years ago? I ask you if you are informed on the fact that a follower of State Department, Steve Pizzenik, he came to Italy as advisor of Italian government has been involved in the complicity against Moro. And he admitted that we we have killed Aldo Moro, he told.
I'm a little familiar with it, but I'm not an authority on it. Our government, just as a matter of course, primarily via the CIA, is involved in most of these conspiracies. That's the nature of empire. We have to do that. You know, we have what? More than, I get two numbers, anywhere from 700 to 1,000 military bases around the world. I mean, it's just sick. It's just sick. And so now, and I could tell you my experiences traveling the world. When I was a senator, I used to run around the world for 2 weeks just to get educated and informed. And when I get into an embassy, sometimes I'd go downstairs in the basement of the embassy, and that's where the CIA office is. And so you sit there. In fact, I once negotiated with North Koreans, and to cover myself, I invited the CIA to brief me ahead of time because I was going to Paris to do this. They did. And the quid pro quo was, well, I'll tell them who's in the room and what happened in the room, because there was nothing I was hiding from. Remember, that was Richard Nixon's thesis, that we're in Vietnam to get our POWs out. That's the reason why we're waging war. That was it for several years, the whole thesis. And so I was trying to convince the North Vietnamese, look it, take all these POWs. You can get a KLM plane, put them on a plane, and send them all back, and there's no rationale to continue the war. And these poor people sitting there, they had sent a person in from Hanoi to meet with me. That was the same time they had invited me to go to North Korea with Jane. With
North Korea or North Vietnam?
North Vietnam, I'm sorry, to Hanoi with, what's her name?
Jane Fonda.
Unfortunately, she didn't, and she admits it today, she didn't use good judgment. And I told him, hell no, you know, I'm not a tool for your propagandist. I do have a, so be it as I say, I just went afield. You know, what happens when you get old and you've been, lived a long time, you get a lot of sea stories that you can tell. So let's end it on that. You're welcome. But I want to make one more thing. If you put it in these stock terms, it really jars you. The President of the United States, like the Emperor of Rome, who had the Praetorian Guard. Well, we have the largest Praetorian Guard in history, and it's funded by black boxes. The Congress doesn't even know where the money is going. And that is the CIA that's at the beck and call of the President of the United States. That's frightening. Okay, next question.
I'm so frightened I can hardly think of what to ask.
Professor,
come on, I've seen you do better now.
Professor Jenkins.
Could we fast forward here? I mean, suppose everything goes swimmingly, just the way you hope it will and planned it will and so on. And this joint agreement is in effect and you've got these states that you're after. Can you tell them, I don't quite understand what the lawmaking provenance of this new institution would be. You said that unless you can make laws, you're really not in the game. So how do we do, how does this institution bring that off, the
First
making
up,
of laws?
The institution is not a lawmaking institution. The legislature is, and we have a legislature of the people. It's called the initiative in 24 states, though it's imperfect. So we're not creating a commission that's going to make laws. We're creating a commission that's going to have power to really investigate. And the only way you can do that is to have the power of subpoena and the power to put people under oath.
All right.
That's all you're going to have. Now, so when you say, intended consequences. Let me give you an unintended consequence. I filibustered and forced the end of the draft in the United States. Mike Mansfield helped me with a filibuster over 5 months, and I was real proud. I say, boy, I ended the draft. Don't you admire me? Well, lo and behold, and the whole theory was Lyndon Johnson expanded to 500,000 troops in Vietnam because he had the draft. So we figured we'd take that power away from them. They won't be able to do this again. Well, lo and behold, what did they do? They didn't expand the troops. They used, which is very politically dangerous, they used the reserves, but then they used private contractors. We've had more people in Iraq without uniforms that had uniforms, and they don't have the code that the military has. And the same thing in Afghanistan, and the same thing in Yemen, the same thing all over the world. And they're diabolical. And make no mistake about it, these are killers. And they have no compunctions of who they will kill. It's all a function of getting their salary, which is generally over $120,000 a year. And they're out there. So that's part of our enemy.
One follow-up.
Please.
This investigative commission, can it make recommendations to the legislature, the state legislatures, for laws?
Oh, not only can it make recommendations, it can make recommendations to the judiciary. It can make recommendations to the federal government. Supposing you discover some real culpable act and you got a name on it, well, you turn that over to the Justice Department and say, prosecute this person. It's a prima facie case of a crime. What are they going to do? And you're making this public. I mean, keep in mind, the people that can just thirst for this stuff as it's developed. And so you'll be able to put this out. Okay, Charlie there just was responsible for that criminal act. And what are you going to do about it? Well, that's it. Exposure in a democracy is really the mother's milk of democracy. That's the reason why WikiLeaks is so great. And Bradley Manning, is that, you know, they just lay it out there. And this charge that this puts our country in jeopardy, it's a lie. There's nothing that WikiLeaks has done that jeopardizes anything. If anything, it initiated the Arab Spring by revealing through a cable of the American ambassador in Tunisia about the corruption in Tunisia. Well, the people knew that the government was corrupt. The difference was that you now had the great United States officially saying he's corrupt, and that set the whole thing ablaze in the Arab world. There's nothing, the instance of it, the Sun system came in, and Graham was kind enough to ask me, well, is it okay for them to come in? Oh, my God, I have never refused an opportunity to make my statements public. There's nothing that I'm doing that needs any secrecy. And if I have any say with this commission, it will be a wide open investigation. And you've got the information there. And that's going to be the cathartic effect on the American psyche on an ongoing basis. That's my intended consequence. There may be other unintended consequences that I have no idea, but I know they will come up.
A question. Thank you. I'm ready to go.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, you were ready. I got you spotted. You were ready to go before that.
A question from Professor Johnson.
Senator, marvelous idea, but I have a couple of questions. When we are faced with the global war on terror, the global war on terror, all bets are off. We change the ground rules, don't we? We have to, because we're in an insecure position. Does the Patriot Act have any impact on your idea, and does it mitigate the opportunity to, say, subpoena military personnel?
No, understand, when we subpoena federal officials, they don't have to show up. Now, they may not be able to travel to Massachusetts or California, because when they do show up within our domain where we've got power, police, we arrest them. They're not following a subpoena. And if they perjure themselves, then we make that public. So the answer to your question is, we can't force anybody who's not within our jurisdiction. But here, you want nanothermite. I heard that Lawrence Livermore was involved with that. Well, where's Lawrence Livermore located? Well, that's in California. And so if we have subpoena powers in California, you darn well better believe you can get any official from Lawrence Livermore to come over and testify and put him under oath. You've got to understand the unintended consequences of this, which I think are awesome, is when we come to the world court, you know, and present them with prima facie cases. I don't know how it, I tell you, I'm not an attorney. I do know this, that when you reveal information, and I saw this happen with the Pentagon Papers, it shakes the timbers. And so anything is possible. The first thing you got to do is do something actionable. You've been doing something informational. You've been doing the research. Now, this has got to be used like a club on our system of representative government. Please.
A question. We have a question from Professor Lee.
Yes. Thank you so much for these inspiring remarks. I thought I'd give you a little reinforcement from the world of anthropology, because for many years, evolutionary anthropology was dominated by the view that the key to human evolution was competition and aggression. And that was very popular in the popular press because it fit with the deep state's agenda. So one of the most interesting developments of the last couple of years is a evolutionary biologist at University of New Mexico named Professor Kim Hill, who was one of these competition aggression guys for years, and he underwent a sea change in which he now has written widely, he and his colleagues, that the secret to human evolution is empathy. And that empathy and ability to experience through your intellect, through your brain, your evolving brain, the suffering of others or the plight of others or the condition of others is now, in his view, one of the key elements that made us human. And so in a very interesting way, the world of science is actually coming around to supporting the position of Laurie Manuel and yourself. And I should just mention one other thing.
Thank you for sharing that with me, because I didn't realize it.
You can look it up, Professor Kim Hill. I, too, was part of the evolutionary movement in anthropology, and I still remember a colleague of mine, because we're going to hear in a bit of time from my colleague about Senator William Fulbright, who must have been someone you knew in your day.
We were close friends.
In the,
okay. I'll tell you a war story about that if you want.
So one of my colleagues described a phone call. He was a Harvard professor, and he described a phone call from Senator Fulbright to him, who's an evolutionary biologist. And he said, I've just been reading what Conrad Lorenz is writing about human evolution. And he says, how are we ever going to get atomic war, atomic weapons off the agenda if Conrad Lorenz is right? And my colleagues reassured him that there's a lot of controversy, and you don't take Conrad Lorenz as the gospel truth. So I thought Fulbright was asking my colleague.
Let me tell you a war story. You'll enjoy this about Fulbright. I had been a senator for about 2 months, and of course Fulbright was one of my heroes in Alaska. And so now I can call him Bill. You know, we're all buddies in the gym there. And so I go up to Bill. He's sitting on the podium presiding, and I said, Bill, you know, I got an idea how we can stop the Vietnam War. And he's listening. I says, let's filibuster the Senate and grind the entire government to a halt, and that will end the war. He says, great idea, Mike. He says, when do you want to start it? Now I feel real good. I got a real senior member, the head of public relations, foreign relations committee, who's backing me on this. And so, fine, we pick a date a couple days later. So we start to filibuster. Well, we lasted 2 hours. And I turned to Bill. I said, God darn it, Bill, don't you know the rules? He says, well, I never had to use it that way. And I had learned this in Alaska when I was Speaker of the House. The first thing you do when you're in a legislative chamber, know the rules, because that's how you play the game. And so I learned the rules, and I became one of the outstanding filibusters of the United States Senate over time. And of course, and I think that the Senate is, of course, one of the undemocratic institutions of our society. You had another question, follow up?
Yes. So your that your idea of the commission that seems to be initiatives well launched in three states and moving forward arouses a lot of optimism. So my question to you is, what counter moves would you anticipate from the powers that we've heard so much about in the last few days?
It's interesting that the truthers in Massachusetts, who are well organized and are very thoughtful people, they can't figure out how anybody is going to oppose once we get the signatures. The key to the game is get the signatures. So you're on the ballot. Now people have to engage in it. They're going to be making a decision, do I vote for this or do I not vote for this? Which means you have now raised to the uppermost level of the constituent's mind a decision that involves all the work you've been doing. This is going to be an open sesame from your point of view. So now they've got to make a decision, and that's where the media is going to come in. And the media will have to pay attention. This is going to be a hot issue. I would hope if we get it in enough states, we could turn around and use it as a wedge issue for the presidential and congressional elections. That means that you go to all their town meetings and say, where do you stand on a commission? And are you for it or against it? And boy, you watch, this is a difficult subject for politicians. Oh, I did not tell you how a politician's mind works, which is very, I got time?
Absolutely, please.
Okay.
We'd love to hear.
Here's, whether I'm a president, I'm a senator, I'm a member of Congress, I'm the governor, I'm on the city council, I'm on the school board, this is the way the mind works. And this is not pejorative. This is just human nature. First thing, I'm about to make a public decision. What comes into my mind is, how is this going to affect my job? And that would apply to any human being in any circumstance. How does it affect my job? How does it affect my getting reelected, getting appointed to something different, or keeping my appointment? So that's the first thing that comes into the person's mind. The second thing that comes into mind of a politician is, how does this affect the people who put the money up to get me here and to keep me here? Because I got to be mindful of their interest all the time. They don't have to tell or ask. When you rise to positions of power, the reason why you rise is because you know how the game is played. And just that simple. So that's the second level. Now the third level is, how does this affect my party? Because my party's in power, I enjoy that power. You see that battle going on in the Congress all the time. And so lo and behold, just imagine, for making a public decision, I'm at the third level, and we haven't even addressed whether my ideology is a barrier or I'm corrupt. Now you can see why generically representative government is dysfunctional. And I was with Cynthia yesterday, and she's really very intense, and we communicate very much by vibes. And she says, Mike, we've got to find a way to, you know, it's terrible out there what's going on in the United States. I said, wait a second, Cynthia, this is the best we've ever had in this country. And I'll tell you right now, it's true. Well, you'll be very surprised. The system of governance in the world today is the best we've ever seen as civilization. Since the beginning of civilization. Well, you say, and then I said, Cynthia. She says, I can't understand that. And wait a second, Cynthia. 20 years ago, they were hanging people of your color in the South, and nobody gave a damn. You know, here, let me tell you what happened in the United States. I've got a chapter, in the last chapter of my book, Citizen Power. And it says, who stole the American dream? I hear that often. Oh, God, the American dream. Oh, tell me about it. So who stole the American dream? Some people thought it was stolen last week with George Bush last month, you know, No, it was stolen in September of 1787 in the writing of the Constitution of the United States. That's when the dream was stolen, because 11 years earlier, the founders, there's the framers and the founders, you have to distinguish. And the founders made the statement, essentially, all human beings are created equal. That's the document that has the American dream or the human dream. Forget America in that regard. We're all the same in the world. That was the human dream. And 11 years later, what did they do? They wiped out the process of the people being involved. You now, to vote prospectively, you got to be a very substantial property owner. And that didn't change until the early part of the next century. And so what did they do? They not only instituted slavery, and of course they already had as their cultural goal the eradication of the indigenous population of the continent, but they not only instituted that, but to put it crudely, they screwed all of you. Because what they did is they did not want to let the people vote to ratify the Constitution. Very interesting. They thought of, Madison thought of, let's have conventions and we'll have the elites go to these conventions and then they will decide whether we ratify the Constitution or not. Well, what were they trying to avoid? They all knew, this was common knowledge, they all knew that in 1776 and 78, at the Continental Congress in 1776, there was an order put out from the Congress to all the states to reorganize themselves. They're declaring independence, so they got to set up a new form of government. So in Massachusetts in 78, they put forth a new constitution. It included slavery. The people voted it down. Now, you had slavery in Massachusetts at the time. The people voted it down. 2 years later, Adams writes a new constitution, and it excludes slavery, and it really sets up the whole process for doing away with slavery. It passed. Now, they knew that, and so when Pinckney took over, and we, you know, it's how we different read the what was going on, took over the convention from Madison was when he was able to get slavery into the Constitution. Up until then, the Constitution was a dead letter. Just read the various statements at the time. But the minute slavery was in there, the lock was in, and they set up in the Constitution five elements that locked in slavery, that the only recourse to change slavery was a civil war. And John Quincy Adams made a great statement. The Civil War was the last battle of the Revolutionary War. And the five elements that were in the Constitution, only one has been removed. The other four are there to create mischief in our process of governance. And the one that was removed was the 3/5 of a person being black. And of course, keep in mind, Tom Jefferson would have lost the election in 1800 to Adams had he not had the votes of the black community, 3/5 of a person. That's what the margin of victory was for him. So the other four elements, we'll tick them off. One is the Senate. I mean, I represented more moose than I did people. Yeah, the Senate. The other is the how you amend the Constitution. The Constitution is Article 5. Do you realize, if you really read the Constitution very carefully and the amendments, you'll realize that we haven't had any amendments worth a darn since our founding. We have a system of governance that was designed then, and now we're in the 21st century. So here, our scientific accomplishments have raced ahead, and we're stuck with a system that's designed for a society that existed in the late 1700s. Does that make any sense? So, and what surprises people is, oh, well, let's change the Constitution. I got to tell you, less than 500 people can stop any change of the Constitution of the United States. Less than 500. Just do the math. You have to have 3/4 of the states. Well, in 3/4 of the states, all of them except Nebraska have bicameral systems. And just count the number of senators in the small states. In Alaska, it's 20 senators. So if you count up what it takes, 13 chambers can stop any change in the Constitution, and add up the people, and you'll see that you can't get an amendment through the Constitution of the United States the way we are presently structured. Little wonder that the ERA amendment, supported by more than 50% of the population, was not able to become an amendment to the Constitution. Now, there's another one, and that is, of course, the Electoral College. I mean, here, a citizen of Alaska or Wyoming has 5 times the vote clout in voting for President of the United States, because the vote is determined by your members of Congress and your senators. So we've got 3. And so our clout 5 times more. So when Alaskans vote for a president and you live in New York or whatever, California, just remember that that person is voting 5 times before you can even vote once. And the final one, which is not at all recognized and is the most important one, is why did the states' rights writers agree to a federal system? Because they knew they would control it. And how did they control it? All federal elections from the get-go were decided and run by state governments. And so if I can, Stalin had a great statement, you can have, vote all you want as long as I count the votes. And that's the way, and we saw an example of that in Florida. You know, you saw it in Ohio. So, and that's something that's not been changed. What did the Congress do? Give them $3 billion so they can go buy some Diebold machines that will help you screw up the election even better. That's what the Congress did. So enough of my war stories. Let me end on this one note, and it's real simple. When you look to solutions in human governance, you can look to governments. And every government in the world is representative except Switzerland. And so if you're what you've got to absorb in your heart of hearts is that the solution is not with the government. The solution is with you as citizens. And I just want to tell you that what you've been doing with the 9/11 movement elevates you to the highest degree of citizenship that I can even think of. Thank you very much.